Oh, good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting. Look at the hiccups. El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, I've made mention of the fact that my wife was attacked at Sam's. Sam's doesn't care. I came to her defense, got between her and the guy that was trying to attack her. And I'm accused of being the aggressor. Well, there have been two other instances of people attacking women they thought were unaccompanied, and the husbands were there. In both cases, they were shot. The husbands, that is. You know, people are going crazy. It's just unbelievable. And, of course, the stores, you know, Sam's wouldn't even call security. And the off-duty officer who was hired to furnish security was busy with his cup of coffee. He couldn't be bothered. He might spill a drop of that coffee. And, of course, I made complaints to everybody, and they just thought it was funny. That guy spends so much money there, they don't want to antagonize him. Now, we've probably spent more because we bought for the companies we worked for at various times, but well, let's not quibble about that. He's a friend of theirs, so they're not going to call security. Well, today's April 2nd, 92nd day of the year. 273 days remain until this year's over with. On this date in 1513, Spanish explorer Juan Ponce de León first sights land in what's now the United States state of Florida, looking for the Fountain of Youth. 1755, Commodore William James captures the Maratha fortress of Suvarnabhumi on the west coast of India. 1792, the Coinage Act is passed, establishing the U.S. Mint. 1800, Ludwig van Beethoven leads the premiere of his first symphony in Vienna. That's where they make those little sausages. 1800, the Treaty of Constantinople establishes the Septensilid Republic, first autonomous Greek state since the fall of the Byzantine Empire. 1801, French Revolutionary War. British captured a Danish fleet. 1851, Rama IV is crowned King of Thailand. 1863, American Civil War. The largest in a series of Southern bread riots occurs in Richmond, Virginia. They should have done what Marie Antoinette suggested. Let them eat cake. 1865, the American Civil War. The defeat at the Third Battle of Petersburg forces an army into Northern Virginia and the Confederate government to abandon Richmond. 1885, Canadian Cree warriors attack the village of Frog Lake, kill 9 people. 1900, U.S. Congress passes the Foraker Act, giving Puerto Rico limited self-rule. 1902, Dmitry Sipayagin, Minister of Interior of the Russian Empire, is assassinated in the Marie Palace in St. Petersburg. 1902, Electric Theater, the first full-time movie theater in the U.S., opens in Los Angeles. 1911, the Australian Bureau of Statistics conducts the country's first census. 1912, the ill-fated RMS Titanic begins its sea trials. Now, there's a backstory to the Titanic sinking. They had a sister ship, I think it was the Olympia, who had run aground a couple of times. And the story goes that the Olympia was made up to look like the Titanic, and the plan by the owners was to let it sink and claim the insurance. I don't think they anticipated what happened. 1917... American entry into World War I. President Wilson asked the U.S. Congress for a declaration of war against Germany. 1921, the autonomous government of Khorasan, a military government encompassing the modern state of Iran, is established. 1930, after the mysterious death of Empress Zweditu, Haile Selassie is proclaimed the Emperor of Ethiopia. The 1956, As the World Turns and Edge of Night. Two soap operas premiered on CBS. They became the first daytime dramas to debut in a 30-minute format. 1964, the Soviet Union launches Zonda 1. 1972, Charlie Chaplin returns to the U.S. for the first time since being labeled a communist during the Red Scare in the early 1950s. If you didn't like somebody, just call him a communist and everybody would rush to hang him. This country has been very good about allegations equal guilt. 1973, launch of LexisNexis, computerized legal research service. 1975, Vietnam War. 1,000 civilian refugees flee from Quang Nai province in the front of the advancing North Vietnamese troops. Now, we had won the war, and then our lily-livered Congress pulled all our troops out, so North Vietnam just came in and took over. 1976, Prince Norodom Sihanouk resigns as leader of Cambodia and is placed under house arrest. 1979, a Soviet biowarfare laboratory in Sverdlovsk accidentally releases airborne anthrax spores, kills 66, plus an unknown amount of livestock. 1980, United States President Jimmy I'm Wonderful Carter signs the Crude Oil Windfall Profits Tax Act. He's also the one that was ordered by his banker to give away the Panama Canal Zone, in spite of the millions and millions of dollars we had poured into it. And he did it. 1982, Falklands War. Argentina invades the Falkland Islands. 1986, Alabama Governor George Wallace, a former segregationist best known for the stand in the schoolhouse door, announces he'll not seek a fifth four-year term and retire from public life when he ends his term in January of 1987. While running for president, there was an assassination attempt to put him in a wheelchair. 1989, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev arrives in Havana, Cuba to meet Fidel Castro in an attempt to mend strained relations. 1991, Rita Johnston becomes the first female premier of a Canadian province, when she succeeds William van der Zalm, who'd resigned as the premier of British Columbia. 1992, in New York, mafia boss John Gotti's convicted of murder and racketeering and is sentenced to life in prison. He was known as the Teflon Don. 1992, 42 civilians are massacred in the town of Bijagina in Bosnia-Herzegovina. 2002, Israeli forces surround the church in a nativity in Bethlehem in which armed Palestinians had retreated. In 2004, Islamist terrorists involved in the March 11, 2004 Madrid attacks attempt to bomb the Spanish high-speed train AVE near Madrid. Luckily, that attack is thwarted. 2006, over 60 tornadoes break out in the U.S. Tennessee is the hardest hit with 29 people killed. 2012, a mass shooting at Oikos University in California leaves 7 people dead and 3 injured. 2014, a spree shooting occurs at the Fort Hood Army Base in Texas. 4 dead, including the gunman, and 16 others are injured. He was a doctor, a psychiatrist, if I'm not mistaken. Unfortunately, the powers that be decided that in garrison you don't carry sidearms. So when somebody starts shooting, you use harsh language. 2015, gunman attack, Garissa University College in Kenya, killing at least 148, wounding 79 others. 2015, 4 men steal items worth up to 200 million pounds from an underground safe deposit facility in London's Hatton Garden area, and what's been called the largest burglary in English legal history. Okay, let us go to a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Abundius of Como, Amphianus of Lycia, A.B. the Younger, Bronk of Glen Sychus, an Irish martyrology, Francis of Paola, Francisco Carl Gartet, Henry Budd in the Anglican Church of Canada, Acetius of Lyon, Pedro Galungsod, Theodosia of Tyre, Urban of Langis, International Children's Book Day and internationally, the Heritage Conservation Day in Thailand, Unity of the Peoples of Russia and Belarus Day in Belarus, and World Autism Awareness Day internationally. Let's see what else we got. Oh, this is also Good Friday. And Sunday is Easter. 1453, Turkish forces under Sultan Mehmed II begin the siege of Constantinople, or Istanbul, as it's known today, which falls May 29th, 1453. 1513, that's Ponce de Leon, first known European to reach Florida. 1801, the Napoleonic Wars. The British, led by Horatio Nelson, destroyed the Danish fleet in the Battle of Copenhagen. 1830, Ras Tafari Mekonnen becomes Emperor Haile Selassie of Abyssinia. We know it as Ethiopia. 2020, a record 6.6 million Americans filed claims for unemployment in the last week, according to the Department of Labor. All right, let's see what else we got. That's not it. Okay. It would seem all right, it's Good Friday. It's Hospital Admitting Clerks Day. International Fact-Checking Day, which is something our media sorely lacks. International Kids Yoga Day, National Ferret Day, National Hot Cross Bun Day, National Kids Yoga Day, National Love Your Produce Manager Day, National Peanut Butter and Jelly Day, National Pro-Life T-Shirt Day, National Walk to Work Day, Pascua, Florida Day, Reconciliation Day, Student Government Day, World Autism Acceptance Day, World Autism Awareness Day, and World Marbles Day. Also, it's APAWS International Pooper Scooper Week, Boys and Girls Club Week, Golden Rule Week, Holy Week, International Pooper Scooper Week, Laugh at Work Week, Make Mine Chocolate. It just amazes me, all the In 999, Gilbert of Alaric elected as the first French Pope. 1416, Alfonso V succeeds his father as King of Aragon. 1550, Jewish physician Joseph Hochhausen expelled from the city of Genoa. Soon after that, all Jews are. You know, I've never understood why people are discriminated against based on unimportant things like ethnicity. 1559, England and France signed the first Treaty of La Chateau-Chambrais. 1590, the States General appoint Earl Mauritius, Viceroy of Utrecht. 1595, Cornelius de Houtman's ships depart to Asia through the Cape of Good Hope. Okay, what else? 1804, 40 merchantmen are wrecked when a convoy led by HMS Apollo runs aground off of Portugal. The entire convoy ran aground. 1819, the first successful agricultural journal, known as the American Farmers, first published. 1827, U.S. inventor Joseph Dixon of Salem, Massachusetts, began manufacturing lead pencils. 1845, H.L. Frizeau and Leon Foucault take the first photograph of the sun. It was shy. It didn't want to have its picture taken. 1864, the skirmish at Crump's Hill, also known as Piney Woods in Louisiana. 1865, Confederate President Jefferson Davis flees the Confederate capital in Richmond. The Confederate treasury was sent toward El Paso and vanished somewhere outside of town. It's never been found. 1865, the Battle of Fort Blakely, Alabama, the last major battle of the U.S. Civil War. 1865, the Battle of Selma, Alabama, Union forces break Confederate defenses and capture the town. On this day in 1866, President Andrew Johnson ends the Civil War in Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. It does not end it in Texas. 1872, U.S. engineer George Brayton patents an internal combustion engine known as the Brayton cycle. 1877 was the first Easter egg roll held on the White House lawn. 1877, the first human cannonball act is performed by 14-year-old Rosa Matilda Richter, known as Zazel, and she did it at the Royal Aquarium in London. 1883, the Battle of Bamako, French assault on Fabius, armed forces attack. 1884, the London's debtors' prison is closed. 1905, the Cairo-Cape Town Railway opens up. 1908, the Mills Committee declares baseball was invented in 1839 by future Civil War General Abner Doubleday in Cooperstown, New York. This became known as the Doubleday Myth. Certainly, he did not invent baseball. 1916, German troops overtake Bois de Caliente. 1916, 57 armed New Zealand police invade the remote Ngāi Tuho settlement in Manjipahatu in the Uruwera ranges to arrest the Maori prophet Rua Kinana. 1917, Jeanette Rankin, Republican from Montana, begins her term as the first woman member of the U.S. House of Representatives. 1926, riots between Muslims and Hindus break out in Calcutta. 1930, the first New York to Bermuda airplane flight lands in Bermuda. 1932, Charles Lindbergh turns over $50,000 in gold backs as ransom for his kidnapped son. The son, it's never been conclusively proven, but his son was supposedly found dead, though there have been a number of pretenders to be the Lindbergh child turn up over the years. And the reason the American mint went from the gold back to the greenback was in order that those who had all the gold backs given by Lindbergh would be easy to spot. 1935, Scottish physicist Robert Watson Watt receives a British patent for radar. In 1942, the USS Hornet, with Jimmy Doolittle's B-25, departs from San Francisco. He bombed Tokyo, if I'm not mistaken. And on that note, I think we've come to the end of today's segment. You know, we've been talking about stories that are strange, and I got some strange ones for you today. You know, there's a lot of myths and legends, especially a lot of myths and legends in England. In the Vale of Glamorgan in southern Wales, you can find a stretch of coast with the second highest tidal range in the world. And along this coast is a place called Barry's Island. And in the rocks, there is a cliff that has a lot of myths that have grown up around it. This legend goes back at least to the time of Episcopalian minister Robert Kirk, who lived in the 1600s. He lived in Aberfoyle. He was born in 1644. Best known for a book he wrote published in 1691 called The Secret Commonwealth. And although the book wasn't published until after his death, it's a book that discusses the reality of fairies, and it collects a vast array of legends and encounters with the little people that took place in the British Isles. And in the case of his entry about Barry's Island, his fairy lore intersected with the stories of King Arthur. According to the story, if you should climb the rocks on Barry's Island, press your ear against the cleft that you'll find there. You'll hear the fairy folk working tirelessly beneath the hill. And just beyond that slim feature of the rocks, you can hear hear what sounds like a forge. And you can hear metal being hit with hammers, which shapes arms and armor day and night. And centuries before, according to the legend, they were tasked to forge arms for Aurelius Ambrosius. That's a legendary war leader who fought against the Anglo-Saxons in the 5th century. And Merlin himself is supposed to have magically bound the fairy tribe. And that binding compels him to keep working until the great wizard himself tells him to stop. Now, of course, Merlin is dead. So there's no one alive to tell the fairies to knock it off. So, if you're a believer in fairies, you might go to Barry's Island and see what you find. You know, sometimes the human mind can accomplish unbelievable things. And there have been a lot of alleged great thinkers who say that our dreaming minds can reveal a great deal. With invaluable pathways to unconscious knowledge and memories, dreams can be harnessed to access secrets we don't even realize that we know. Now, it's said that Thomas Edison used his dreaming mind to troubleshoot inventions when he got stuck. And he was hardly alone in finding both inspiration and revelation in his dreams. Elias Howe, inventor of the lock-stitch sewing machine, had his final design of the needle come to him in a dream. And similarly, Friedrich August Kekulé, the German chemist who determined the structure of benzene, said that he had this information appear to him in a dream. Now, scientists and inventors aren't the only ones to have benefited from revelations accessed by their unconscious mind during dreams. 19th century Assyriologist Dr. Hermann von Hilprecht had a dream that helped him solve the puzzle surrounding a set of Babylonian artifacts. And either this solution came from the depths of his own unconscious mind, or he was visited in his sleep by the guiding spirit of an ancient Mesopotamian priest. For his part, the professor was never sure which was the truth. The story begins in 1892 at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Hilprecht was a professor of Assyriology there. That's the study of the Assyrian civilization. Previously, the university had sponsored an expedition to several locations important to the history of Babylon, including Nippur, where a grand temple to the god Bel once stood. And Dr. Hilprecht was responsible for sharing the latest findings on the artifacts recovered by the expedition in his new book, The Babylonian Expedition to the University of Pennsylvania, Series A, Old Babylonian Inscription, Chiefly from Nippur. Now, by mid-March, the proofs of the book to be published had arrived, and Dr. Hilprecht was expected to make any minor changes he thought necessary and then approve the proofs for the publisher. Excuse me. There were two artifacts that troubled him. The artifacts in question were small rings of agate, of which only fragments remained. And Dr. Hilprecht, uncertain what they were, finally identified them as finger rings. And based on their partial inscriptions, he dated them to the Kassite period of Babylonian history between 1700 and 1140 B.C. One of the fragments had a syllable on it that suggested a connection with King Kurigalzu, who lived about 1300 B.C., although this interpretation was tentative at best. And part of the professor's problem was that he was working from field drawings of the fragments, not the objects themselves. The actual pieces of agate were housed in a museum in Istanbul, which was in Turkey. With the deadline from the publisher approaching, he had to make a decision about what his book would say about these fragments. Ultimately, he decided to mention Kurigalzu for the one, but for the other, he consigned the vast number of unclassified Kassite pieces. Well, having researched diligently the entire day, he was exhausted and still not 100% certain of his interpretation of these two pieces. He signed off on the proof sheets and went to bed. In his dream, he said that he was visited by a strange figure from the past. The man was tall, about 40, and dressed in a simple tunic. From his features and clothes and coloration, the professor identified him in his own mind as a priest from the Babylonian era. Ancient priest approached the professor and beckoned him to follow him. When Hilprecht stepped after the priest, he found himself traveling backward into the past till they stood together in a low-ceiling room that didn't have any windows. Fragments of lapis lazuli and agate covered the floor, and a large wooden chest stood off to one side. Hilprecht felt that he had arrived at the ancient temple of Bel long before the walls of the place had crumbled to dust. As the professor marveled at his surroundings, the robed priest turned to him and explained the history of the two fragments that had so puzzled the professor. They weren't finger rings, but they were pieces of what had once been a votive cylinder. According to the priest, the cylinder had been a gift to the temple of Bel from King Kurigalzu, but had been cut into three separate pieces when that same king issued an order for the priest to construct a pair of agate earrings for the statue of the god Ninib, the son of Bel. Only two of those pieces had been found by the University of Pennsylvania's expedition, and the ancient priest insisted the third ring would never be uncovered. And Hilprecht was told that he could confirm the truth of the story if he looked at the edges of the two fragments and put them back together. Inscription would become clearer once the two portions were reunited. And after giving this message to the professor, the priest vanished. Well, Hilprecht woke up with that dream fresh in his mind and wrote it down in every detail. Astounded and elated by his nighttime discovery, he related the entire experience to his wife. And the next day, he re-examined the fragments, and sure enough, they could be pieced together, and in doing so, their inscription became clear. To the god Ninib, son of Bel, his lord, has Kurigalzu, pontifex of Bel, presented this. But when he told his friend, Professor William Romaine Newbold, about his dream and his discovery on the inscription, Newball pointed out one possible problem. The original descriptions of the fragments recorded by the archaeologist Dr. John Peters made it clear the two agate fragments were different colors. And Newbold worried that this meant they couldn't possibly come from the same object. Hilprecht, of course, wasn't sure. Later that summer, he had the opportunity to examine the fragments themselves, visited Istanbul, traveled to the museum where the objects were housed. And there he met Halil Bey, the director of the museum. After he told Bey about his dream, they both examined the fragments together. And just as Dr. Peters had initially observed, the pieces were different colors of agate. But it was banded agate. And closer inspection revealed the cylinder had been cut almost perfectly along one of the lines of color. These two pieces were clearly part of the same object. So what the priest said in Hilprecht's dream was confirmed, although whether the priest of Bel had been a convenient manifestation of his own unconscious mind or a 3,000-year-old ghost, even Hilprecht couldn't say. But you take your information where it comes from. You know, turning from mysterious priest, let's talk about poltergeist. Now, poltergeist are referred to, that word means noisy spirits. And they're believed to have the power to transport objects through the air, throw small items, knock breakables off shelves, and in the modern age, interfere with electronic devices, typically in destructive ways. In the past, poltergeist phenomenon was generally attributed to the activity of a spirit, maybe a demon. Sometimes this spirit was thought to be non-human, and as I said, demonic, or in some instances, fey. More recent times, the general opinion of poltergeist phenomena has changed toward a theory involving the central living person involved in the poltergeist case itself being the cause of it. Such an individual is called a nexus, at least according to paranormal investigator Harry Price, and is seen to be the actual cause of the movement of objects through a latent and largely unconscious form of telekinesis. Now, it's wildly held in current paranormal thought that the living human nexus of poltergeist phenomena is typically a young girl around the age of puberty, and sometimes inherent in the tumultuous hormonal emotional shifts associated with puberty, you find the setting off or fueling of the phenomenon. And although most modern readers probably learned the poltergeist phenomena through a series of movies from the 80s, most notably the movie Poltergeist with the haunted child Carol Ann, poltergeist phenomena has actually been recorded for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. One interesting tale of early poltergeist phenomena is recorded in Scotland's Social and Domestic Memorials of Life and Manners in North Britain. It was written by Reverend Charles Rogers and was published in 1869. And this particular book tells about the famous Ringkopf poltergeist. Now, this was an ongoing phenomenon in the parish of Rerick, which is in Scotland. It took place in the late 1600s. According to the write-up on the case, and this came from page 246 of the Rogers text, during the months of February, March, and April 1695, the house of Andrew Mackey, a mason, in Ringcroft, parish of Rerick, in Cudbrightshire, was a scene of strange phenomena. Stones and missiles of all kinds were thrown into the house as if by an invisible hand. Voices were heard uttering denunciations and warnings and adjuring them to repent. Misses written with blood were thrown about the premises. Members of the family were beaten with invisible rods and dragged about mercilessly. The neighboring clergy assembled and subscribed a declaration certifying the phenomena. Now, Rogers himself was quoting from earlier sources recorded by the minister overseeing the investigation, a Reverend Alexander Telfair, minister of the parish of Rerick and the stewartry of Kirkcudbright. He was called in by Mackey to put an end to the mysterious events that were disturbing his family. Now, Telfair attempted to clear the infestation with prayer and fasting, but generally got bludgeoned about the head by flying stones for his trouble. In the end, five other ministers, in addition to Telfair, got involved, as well as the blacksmith and several other laymen. But to nobody's surprise, no amount of fasting, prayer, or other attempts could still the ghostly activities. Eventually, the phenomena ceased on its own, inspiring Telfair to conclude his narration of the events with the following statement. Now, all things aforesaid being of undoubted verity, therefore I conclude with that of the apostle. 1 Peter, verse 8 through 9. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour, and whom resist steadfast in the faith. Well, this quote makes it abundantly clear what Telfair felt the family had been dealing with throughout that strange spring of 1695. And no matter what had happened, you can be sure the good minister found a Bible verse to cover it. Was he right? Yeah. No way to tell. Well, there is, according to the classic song, The Devil Went Down to Georgia, the devil is actually a fiddle player. And in that song, the devil appears to challenge a young fiddle player named Johnny. And Johnny, according to the song, was the best that ever was, and he knows it. So the devil takes advantage of Johnny's sinful pride, betting him a golden violin if Johnny can outplay Old Scratch. And the song is a rousing mix of story and melody, and it draws upon a well-established tradition in Southern folklore where the devil shows up to wage a bet for a boastful person's soul. Well, the devil's connection with the violin is a whole lot older than this 1979 Charlie Daniels Band song. Around 1749, the devil reportedly appeared to a real-life fiddle player and offered an agreement. The fiddle player was none other than renowned Baroque violinist Giuseppe Tartini. He was a composer. In addition to being a master of the violin, created one of his most breathtaking works after a very peculiar dream. While Tartini slept, he dreamed the devil appeared to him, and they made an agreement. As part of the agreement, the devil did whatever Tartini would bid him. And curious about the devil's skill on his favorite instrument, Tartini handed Old Scratch his violin, asking him to play. In the dream, the devil admitted he could manage a few tunes and proceeded to play a sonata that left Tartini utterly dumbfounded. In Tartini's own words, according when he wrote down everything that happened, "Imagine my surprise when I heard a sonata so unusual and so beautiful, performed with such master and intelligence, on a level I had never before conceived was possible." Well, Tartini was so overcome with the beauty and mastery of the devil's violin work in his dream, he awoke grasping for breath. He immediately woke up. When he woke up, immediately got his own violin in the waking world and tried to recreate the infernal melody of his dream. Although Tartini felt he didn't even come close, the resulting sonata is considered a masterpiece. Tartini called it the devil's thrill. And everyone who's attempted to play it will admit it seems almost inhuman in its complexity. So was he in another reality, so to speak, actually communing with the devil? We'll probably never know. Well, from there, let's go to Crybaby Bridge. That's a haunted location often frequented by area teens looking for a spooky thrill late at night. According to the story, a local girl had an unwanted baby and in despair walked to the bridge and tossed the infant into the water. And at night, it's said, you can still hear the unfortunate baby wailing miserably, its spirit unable to find rest because of its terrible death. The haunted bridge is located in Columbus, Georgia, and I've seen the bridge. I was there. But there's another Crybaby Bridge in New Hope, Pennsylvania. In fact, there are no less than 24 haunted locations known as Crybaby Bridge in the state of Ohio alone. So how do you explain that? When some of the stories connected with the haunted bridge, the mother didn't throw the infant to its death below, but instead was walking along with her child and fell to her own death with the baby still in her arms. And a few of these hauntings even get more elaborate. They merely involving claims of ghostly wailing. Some suggested baby powder sprinkled along the bridge, the footprints of a small child will show up. Other visitors have The so-called Crybaby Bridges claim to have discovered the prints of tiny hands on the woods or side of their car once they've driven away. So given a profusion of Crybaby Bridge stories and locations, it's obvious this haunting is much more an urban legend than a ghostly fact. But again and again, people who visit these locations report encountering real phenomena. And in fact, investigators at the Columbus, Georgia version of Crybaby Bridge even brought back some fairly clear EVPs. So you have to ask yourself, what's going on with these bridges? One possibility has less to do with distraught mothers who drown their infants and more to do with the nature of the bridges themselves. Much like a crossroads, a bridge is an area or an in-between place. It's something that leads from one place to the next. And as a mythic symbol, a bridge is then neither here nor there, a perfect location for spirits that don't properly belong to our earthly realm to cross over, if only for a little while. Notably in voodoo, there's a minor loa known as Tijin Quinto, who reportedly lives under bridges. And haunted bridges are not just an American phenomenon. Many of the stories can be traced back to ancient times. All the tales of haunted bridges contain the same mythic, universal elements as all the Crybaby Bridge stories. Maybe at the end of the day, we just have a gut response to bridges that deals less with spirits, more with psychology. But then again, maybe there's something to be said about that between the worlds idea after all. Well, from Crybaby Bridge in Columbus, Georgia, let's go to the mysterious Hangar 18, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, Dayton, Ohio, which is where Wright-Patterson is not a remarkable town. Few people outside of Ohio might have even heard of it, if not for the presence of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And this military base started life merely as Wright Field, named after the Ohio-born brothers who invented modern aviation. Allegedly, not long after the U.S. crash at Roswell, New Mexico, all that changed. Material from the New Mexico crash was said to have been transported to Dayton. And Wright Field became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, many ufologists believe since that fateful summer in 1947, Wright-Patterson has been used to store not only wreckage from downed alien craft, but also the bodies of the pilots. It wasn't long before rumors began to circulate about the mysterious Blue Room and more widely about Hangar 18. Stories about this top-secret location in the Air Force Base were so persistent that in the 1960s, Senator Barry Goldwater, one of the most powerful senators in Congress, stopped in at the base and sought permission to view Hangar 18 from General Curtis LeMay. LeMay was a close friend of his. And LeMay told him, in no uncertain terms, he couldn't go in it. He couldn't see it. Even LeMay didn't have clearance high enough to let him go in that building. Now, a variety of credible witnesses have come forth claiming to have seen some of the bizarre things stored at Wright-Patterson. Norma Gardner, who worked at the base for a number of years, had a high security clearance, claimed to have been responsible for photographing, tagging, and cataloging material recovered from crashed UFOs. She also claimed to have seen the bodies of two aliens on at least one occasion. Physicist Robert Sarbacher, a consultant to the Department of Defense's Research and Development Board, made a startling statement to a group of Canadian scientists, September 15, 1950. He said the U.S. government had alien materials in its possession, and further, he'd been trying to duplicate the performance without much success. Retired Air Force officer Arthur Exon testified that alien crash remains were brought to Wright Field while he was serving there in 1947. Exon went on to become a brigadier general in 1964. He was named the Wright-Patterson base commander. Even with this high rank, he was still denied direct access to any of the material studies being carried out upon that alien material. He also asserted that among the materials gleaned from the 1947 crash were actual alien bodies, and these were under study at Wright-Patterson. He remains to this point in time the highest-ranking military person to come forward with a statement regarding the Roswell crash. Now, given all these accounts, it seems highly credible that something top secret was at least at one time going on at Wright-Patterson. But the question becomes, does the Dayton Bay still harbor the mysterious materials in Hangar 18? One retired Air Force pilot, speaking under the condition of anonymity, told UFO researcher Leonard Stringfield that at least some of the items originally stored Wright-Patterson later moved to a site in Colorado Springs. Even if nothing extraterrestrial remains at the Ohio Air Force Base, the legend of Hangar 18 has become such an iconic part of modern UFO mythology that rumors about what's really there are likely to continue indefinitely. Well, from UFOs, let's talk about ESP. You've probably seen them flashed on episodes of The X-Files on the covers of Time Life books. They were a deck of simple symbols, black against white, five images total. They're known as Ryan cards, after Dr. J.B. Ryan, the founder of the Ryan Institute and the pioneer of modern parapsychology. However, Dr. Ryan himself originally named them after his assistant, Carl Zinner. Zinner cards are designed to test psychic abilities. Telepathy, clairvoyance, and even precognition can be measured with this deck of cards. Or at least statistical anomalies in an individual's mean accuracy can strongly suggest that something more than random chance is going on. For years, Ryan and Zinner experimented with the cards, amassing statistics to prove that humans have a kind of sixth sense. Although many scientists still refuse to recognize significance in parapsychological research, Ryan and Zinner nevertheless proved that something real was actually going on with their subjects. Those that were able to accurately identify the images on the cards, sight unseen. Now, the cards are designed with simple, iconic images, so there can be less likelihood of an image getting confused with something else during the process of transmission. The idea is for the individual holds the deck and is looking at each card in succession to try sending the message to a receiver. Now, that receiver might be in the next room or they might be miles away. Theoretically, with such powers as telepathy, proximity really doesn't matter. The key instead lies in the psychic connection between the two minds. Similar experiments can be run with a simple deck of cards, but actual playing cards have a greater number of variables to consider when analyzing results. With actual playing cards, there's color, suit, and even the images that appear on the face cards like the kings and the queens. A sender may just pull a face card and start thinking about a living person. If the receiver records something too metaphorical, then it becomes much harder to judge the real accuracy that it hit. Researchers in the Maimonides Dream Institute ran into problems like this when running experiments involving works of art transmitted through dream telepathy. Several dreamers received images related to the artwork, but were so interpretive the data essentially had to be thrown out. This is where the simplicity of Jenner cards is designed to make it easier to identify a hit when one occurs. Since their initial use in J.B. Ryan's experiments, the Jenner cards have become something of a legend. Their online that detailed their proper use in experiments. There are even a few sites where you can participate in the simple Jenner card experiments yourself. Now, these sites, of course, are computer-generated, nullifying the chance that your answers might be gleaned through telepathy, but precognition might still be measured through the use of such simple computer-generated tests. Well, there are stories that certain personalities don't die. And the history books tell many tales about General George S. Patton, Jr. He was actually a colorful individual. From his exploits with the United States Tank Corps during World War I to his pentathlon competition in 1912 Olympics, he swore he only lost first place because he neatly put one bullet through a hole left in the target by another. To an infamous situation where he slapped two shell-shocked World War II soldiers in a misguided attempt to get them back into the fight, he certainly left an impression wherever he went. When he was stationed at Fort Benning, Phoenix City, which is right across the Chattahoochee River, balanced its budget by arresting soldiers who came over there to go to nightclubs and bars. And organized crime started to rob them and kill them. In fact, they had to stretch nets across the river downstream to catch the bodies. And one evening, almost an entire company of his soldiers got arrested. And he drove his tanks up on the 13th Street Bridge and sent a message to the mayor of Phoenix City. His troops were returned or they'd lose their courthouse. Well, of course, they called the commander at Fort Benning, which is in Columbus, Georgia, and complained, and he said, I'm not going to oppose Patton. You must think I'm a fool. So all the troops were returned, and Patton took his tanks back to the barracks. Well, we know Patton went to West Point, that he came from a military family, and he was designed a unique type of cavalry saber, and even established rules for fencing, not with foils, but with broadswords. But what we don't normally talk about is his belief in reincarnation. Now, while his family's military heritage undoubtedly played a role in his chosen profession, the man himself insisted he was drawn to a life of soldiering because he'd always been a warrior. And when he died, he would be reborn into a warrior's life again. Now, as a young man, Patton wrote a lengthy poem detailing what he believed were his various incarnations. The poem was entitled Through a Glass Darkly. The rhyming quatrains tell of lives that stretch into prehistory. Now, he admits he can't name every battle, but gives details about fighting in a phalanx against Cyrus and later fighting as a legionnaire in Rome. He claims to have died on Cressy's Field during the 14th century conflict between England's Edward III and France's Philip VI, and have held the rank of general as he galloped across the continent with Marat under Napoleon. Now, you might dismiss this poem as a young man's fancy, but there's a persistent tale told about Patton's time in Tunisia during World War II. The general was traveling by jeep to an active battlefield. An increasingly intense and agitated Patton called out directions to his driver, certain something important lay very near. Finally, he ended up near the Kasserine Pass, the site of a bloody massacre of 1,000 American troops butchered in their first encounter with the German war machine under Field Marshal Rommel. With the path in the distance, Patton insisted his driver stop. The land about him was empty, desolate, nothing moving. Patton got out, surveyed the field, and finally seemed to be satisfied. He then described to those with him a heated battle between the Carthaginian and three Roman legions took place on that spot. He insisted he had fought and died on that very battlefield in 146 B.C. Well, later on, his story was checked for accuracy by some of the other folks that were with him, and it found that everything he said was absolutely true. Well, because the paranormal and... Okay, once again, because paranormal and numinous experiences are marginalized in Western culture, those who experience these events are often dismissed as crazy or delusional. And having been raised within the limits of Western culture, we often doubt the empirical evidence of our own direct experiences and struggle with the idea we might be insane. But one of the founders of modern psychology not only studied these abilities, he believed in them himself. That's Carl Gustav Jung. He was an early student of Dr. Sigmund Freud. His work was influential in the evolving discipline of psychology. Later, he became Freud's biggest rival. Jung is remembered as one of the fathers of modern psychology. Although it's often swept under the rug, Jung was, in addition to his brilliant work in psychology and psychoanalysis, he was a mystic who studied Gnosticism and shamanism and often participated in seances early in his career. His experiences with paranormal events, in part, inspired his theory of synchronicity. In his book, The Undiscovered Self, Jung went into detail discussing such things as destruction and physiology of the brain and the events of psychic phenomena. Notably, one of the core arguments that drove Jung and Freud apart revolved around Jung's mysticism. Freud felt psychology, if it were to be taken seriously as a science, had no room for paranormal beliefs. Well, despite the hard stance Freud took against the paranormal throughout his career, even he couldn't avoid it. He's widely known as the first person in modern times to document the phenomenon known as dream telepathy. Well, from Freud, let's go to the father of Fortean phenomenon, the indubitable Charles Fort. All those events that defied the natural order as it's currently understood falls under the what we might refer to as Fortean phenomena. Rains of frogs, invasions of previously undocumented insects, chunks of wood or other matter that fall mysteriously from the sky. He documented everything. Asking hard questions about what these events told us about the world in which he lived. Fort began his career as a newspaper reporter in New York at the turn of the 20th century. And through this work, he became intrigued by stories of events that simply didn't fit in the rational view that science applied to the world. Now, Fort himself took a view of extreme skepticism toward the world in general. He didn't believe in anything, least of all what he perceived to be the flimsy attempts made by science to present a neat and rational view of the world. In fact, he had a particular dislike of science. He seemed to take perverse pleasure in knocking modern scientists down a few pegs by unearthing stories that threw a monkey wrench into their theories on physics and biology and reality in general. For 27 years, he pored over newspapers and journal articles, put stories together about things that didn't fit. He had little structure in his collections of these articles, and his overall purpose seemed to have been merely to present visions of the impossible, and through these visions call into question the methods by which modern individuals tried to order the world. Now, his research gave rise to a number of books, which I've read and think are fascinating. He wrote in 1919, The Book of the Damned, and in 1923, he wrote a book called New Lands. He also wrote another one called L-O. In addition to his books that merely collected articles and reports of extraordinary and improbable experiences, he was also a prolific fiction writer. Now, little of his fiction remains, as he was known to burn thousands of pages in fits of depression. He had the audacity to write his autobiography at the age of 25, even though Fort himself later on said this was a little presumptuous. Through the work of his friend, Tiffany Thayer, Fort's work was carried on after his death. Thayer founded the Fortean Society, as well as other Fort-inspired organizations and publications that continued to explore the edges of acceptable reality, and they raised questions that no one has yet been able to answer. Now, in our next show, which will be on Monday, because this is a Friday. In fact, this is Good Friday. We're going to be talking about some of the weird stories about UFOs, such as the Bentwater UFO incident. I mean, they say lightning never strikes in the same place twice, but that's not the case with UFOs. The Royal Air Force Base, located at Lincoln Heath, Bentwaters, in England, was the site of two significant UFO encounters spaced almost exactly 25 years apart. Now, it's a NATO-affiliated air base, and witnesses at the base reported the first incident in 1956. On the night of August 12th of that year, UFOs were spotted in the base's airspace. And we're going to go into a great deal of detail about the Bentwaters incident in our next show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.